A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about cognitive dissonance. Not the pop psychology version people throw around when someone's being hypocritical, but the real thing. He sent this in after our episode on institutional dysfunction in Israel, and I want to read what he actually wrote, because the way he frames it's worth hearing in full.
Go for it.
He says, in that earlier episode about the slow accumulating dysfunction in daily institutions, I mentioned cognitive dissonance, the gap between a media depiction of resilience in the face of war and stressors, and the lived experience of systems crumbling and breaking down. He loved that point. Then he connects it to something he's mentioned before, his love of the theater of the absurd and explorations of our relationship to reality. He thinks cognitive dissonance sits adjacent to that kind of exploration. Cognitive dissonance, he says, is sort of the emperor has no clothes phenomenon, and perhaps these days, more than ever, it seems to be everywhere all at once. So his questions are, how did the term cognitive dissonance come to be, and come to be adopted in our daily vocabulary, and what non-obvious effects does it have when everybody is feeling this subtly, and wondering if they're the only one, or if they're living in some alternate reality? And then he closes with this line, maybe more than any other everyday experience, cognitive dissonance is truly worthy of the term crazy-making.
That last line, that's the one that lands.
It is. And it's not just a feeling. There's a mechanism underneath it. So let's actually dig into where this term came from, how it escaped the lab, and why it might be the most accurate description of modern life right now.
Let's start with what it actually is, because that's where most people get it wrong. Cognitive dissonance isn't just feeling conflicted, it's not having mixed feelings, it's not even hypocrisy, though people use it that way constantly. It's a specific mechanism Leon Festinger laid out in 1957, the psychological discomfort that comes from holding two contradictory cognitions simultaneously. And here's the part people miss. The mind treats that discomfort as something it needs to reduce. It's aversive arousal. Your brain registers the contradiction almost like a threat, and it moves to resolve it, often without you being aware it's happening.
So it's not the gap itself. It's what the gap makes you do.
The gap is the trigger. The response is the phenomenon. And the response can take a few forms. You can change one of the beliefs, you can add new beliefs that bridge the contradiction, or you can just downgrade the importance of the whole thing. Tell yourself it doesn't matter.
Which is probably the most common move in everyday life. This doesn't actually bother me.
Right. And that's the one that's hardest to spot, because it happens so fast and so quietly. You don't feel yourself doing it.
So where did Festinger get this from? Because theories don't usually come from nowhere.
They don't. And this origin story is genuinely wild. In 1954, Festinger and a couple of colleagues read a newspaper article about a woman in Chicago named Dorothy Martin, though in the literature she's called Marion Keach, the pseudonym they gave her. She was the leader of a small doomsday cult called the Seekers. She claimed she was receiving messages from aliens on the planet Clarion, and those messages told her the world would end in a massive flood on December 21st, 1954.
Classic.
But here's where it gets interesting. Festinger and his team didn't just read about this and theorize from a distance. They infiltrated the group. They posed as believers, embedded themselves in the cult, and were present in the room on December 20th, the night before the prophecy, and then through the night of the 21st, when nothing happened.
They were inside the moment of disconfirmation.
They were inside it, and what they documented became the foundation of the entire theory. The prophecy failed. The world didn't end. No flood, no flying saucer rescue. And the group's response was not, as you might expect, to say, oh, we were wrong. It was the opposite. They became more fervent. Within hours, Dorothy Martin announced she'd received a new message. The group's faith had been so powerful that God had decided to spare the world. They'd saved humanity. And the believers, most of them, accepted this. They didn't just accept it, they leaned in harder. They started proselytizing more aggressively than before.
So the failure of the prophecy made the belief stronger, not weaker.
That's the finding that launched the whole field, because it's counterintuitive. You'd think evidence against a belief would weaken it. But when someone has invested enough in a belief, time, identity, relationships, reputation, the cost of abandoning it's higher than the cost of twisting reality to preserve it. The mind does the cheaper thing.
And Festinger saw this in real time.
In real time. He published the cult study in 1956 in a book called When Prophecy Fails, and then the full theoretical framework the next year in A Theory of Cognitive Dissonance. And that framework made a specific prediction: the less external justification someone has for doing something that contradicts their beliefs, the more they'll change their beliefs to match the action. Because if you can point to a good reason, you did it. They paid me a lot of money, someone forced me. You don't need to adjust your internal world. But if the external reason is weak, your mind has to manufacture internal consistency.
This is the famous $1, $20 experiment.
Festinger and Carl Smith, 1959. They brought participants into a lab and had them do an excruciatingly boring task, turning pegs on a board for an hour. Then they told each participant, the person who was supposed to tell the next subject, that the task was enjoyable couldn't make it. Could you fill in? Half were offered $1 to do it. Half were offered $20. Afterward, they asked everyone how much they actually enjoyed the task.
And the people paid $1 said they liked it more.
Significantly more. Because $20, which in 1959 was real money, gave you a story, I lied because I got paid. No dissonance. But $1, that's not enough to justify lying. So your mind, below awareness, shifts your attitude. Maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe I actually found it kind of interesting. The belief changes to match the behavior.
That's unsettling. It means the less someone is paid to believe something, the more they might actually believe it.
That's the uncomfortable implication, yes. And it's been replicated in dozens of variations. The mechanism is robust. Dissonance produces measurable physiological arousal, skin conductance, heart rate changes. It's not abstract. Your body reacts to the contradiction.
So how does this go from a lab finding in the 50s to something people say at dinner parties?
The 60s helped. The Vietnam War created a massive, society-wide gap between official narratives and what people were seeing on television every night. The government says progress, the footage says bodies coming home. The counterculture latched onto the term because it named something they were all feeling, that the public story and the private experience didn't match. And once a term like that enters the political vocabulary, it doesn't leave.
And then it just diffuses.
Through the decades. By the 90s, it's on daytime talk shows. Someone's cheating husband gets analyzed through the lens of he's experiencing cognitive dissonance. By the 2000s, it's in self-help books and business seminars. By the 2010s, it's a meme format. The term becomes a way to name the feeling that reality doesn't add up. And that's useful. But it also dilutes the precision. When everything is cognitive dissonance, nothing is.
Right. If you use it to mean someone is being inconsistent, you've lost the mechanism. The mechanism isn't inconsistency. It's the automatic, often unconscious drive to resolve inconsistency by any means available.
And that's where the crazy-making part comes in. Because if the mechanism operates below awareness, you don't know what's happening. You just feel off. Something doesn't fit. But you can't name what.
So, let's go to the theater of the absurd, because Daniel's connection here isn't just a literary aside, it's structural.
It really is. The theater of the absurd emerges in the 1950s. Beckett's Waiting for Godot premieres in 1953, Ionesco's Rhinoceros in 1959. Same moment, basically, as Festinger's lab work. Different domain. Same underlying observation.
Say more about that.
The absurd, in Camus' formulation, is the conflict between the human need for meaning and the universe's refusal to provide it. We demand coherence. The world gives us silence. That gap is the absurd condition. And the plays that come out of this tradition dramatize characters trapped in exactly that gap. They're trying to make sense of a situation that doesn't make sense, using the tools of reason in a context where reason doesn't apply.
Vladimir and Estragon waiting for someone who never comes.
And they can't stop waiting. They can't leave. The structure of the play is two people, a tree, a road, and the promise of someone named Godot who will arrive and give meaning to their waiting. He never does. But they don't conclude, this is meaningless, let's go. They keep waiting. They fill the time with routines, with conversations that loop, with small distractions. They're reducing dissonance constantly without ever resolving it.
That's the play version of exactly what Festinger described. The failed prophecy doesn't break the belief. It produces new reasons to keep believing.
And in Rhinoceros, it's the opposite structure but the same mechanism. Everyone in a town starts turning into rhinoceroses. At first, the protagonist, Berengar, resists. This is absurd. It's not happening. But one by one, everyone around him converts. His friends, his colleagues, his love interest. They all find reasons. It's natural. It's inevitable. It's actually quite beautiful. And by the end, Berengar is the last human, alone, shouting that he won't capitulate. But the play leaves you wondering, is his resistance noble, or is he the one who's insane?
That's the social dimension. The dissonance isn't just inside one person's head. It's between what one person sees and what everyone around them insists is true.
Which brings us to The Emperor's New Clothes. Anderson published that story in 1837, and it's basically a cognitive dissonance experiment in fairy tale form. Two weavers promise the emperor a suit of clothes invisible to anyone who's stupid or unfit for their position. The emperor can't see it. His ministers can't see it. The crowd can't see it. But nobody says anything, because admitting you can't see, it means admitting you're stupid or incompetent, so everyone performs belief. The dissonance is between, I see a naked man, and if I say that, I lose my status. The resolution is to pretend, and the spell only breaks when a child says what everyone is thinking. The child hasn't internalized the social cost of honesty. The utterance, he's not wearing anything, converts private dissonance into shared reality in an instant. And that's the thing about collective dissonance. It's sustained by silence. Everyone privately doubts, but everyone assumes they're the only one doubting, so no one speaks.
That's the crazy making. You're sitting there thinking, am I the crazy one? Everyone else seems fine with this.
And the more people around you perform acceptance, the stronger the pressure to doubt your own perception. This isn't just social conformity, it's epistemological erosion. You stop trusting your own eyes.
Which is exactly the feeling Daniel's naming. The gap between the official story of resilience and the lived experience of systems breaking down. You see the cracks. But the narrative says everything is holding. And you look around and nobody's saying anything, so you think, maybe I'm imagining it.
And here's the knock-on effect that doesn't get talked about enough. Chronic unresolved dissonance isn't just uncomfortable in the moment. Over time, it degrades your ability to trust your own judgment. If you're constantly receiving inputs that contradict each other, the news says one thing, your eyes say another, your neighbors seem to accept the news version, you start to develop a kind of learned self-doubt. You stop believing your own perceptions are reliable.
That's the alternate reality feeling Daniel mentions. It's not that you've switched to a different reality, it's that you're not sure which one you're in.
And it compounds, because once you doubt your own perception, you become more dependent on external validation. You look to others to confirm what's real. But if they're also performing, also hiding their doubt, the whole thing becomes a hall of mirrors. Everyone's looking at everyone else for cues, and nobody's willing to be the child in the crowd.
The speed of information now makes this worse, doesn't it?
Massively worse. In Festinger's time, a dissonance-inducing event happened occasionally. A failed prophecy, a political scandal, a personal contradiction. You had time to process it. Now? The contradictions arrive faster than the mind can resolve them. You can experience 3 or 4 dissonance triggers before breakfast. The news cycle, social media, the constant stream of claims and counterclaims. Your brain is being asked to reconcile contradictions on an industrial scale, and it wasn't built for that throughput.
So the resolution mechanisms get sloppy. You start using the cheapest ones, trivializing, ignoring, numbing out, because you don't have the cognitive bandwidth for anything deeper.
That creates a kind of chronic low-grade dissonance that never fully resolves. It's like running a background process on your mental CPU that never quits. You feel it as fatigue, as irritability, as a vague sense that things don't add up. But you can't quite say why. That's the crazy-making texture. It's not a single acute episode of contradiction. It's the accumulated weight of hundreds of small ones.
What do you actually do with this? Because we've just described a mechanism that's automatic, often unconscious, socially reinforced, and now accelerated to the point where it's basically ambient. That sounds bleak.
It does. But there are moves. The first one is just naming it. The moment you can say, I'm experiencing cognitive dissonance right now, you've created a gap between you and the mechanism. You're no longer inside it, you're observing it.
Which is half the battle.
It's most of the battle, honestly. The mechanism works best when you don't know it's working. Awareness breaks the spell. And then you can ask the practical question, which cognition am I protecting? The discomfort is a signal. It's pointing at a belief that's under threat. If you can identify that belief, you have agency. You can decide whether to keep it, modify it, or let it go.
The discomfort becomes information instead of just pain.
It's diagnostic. I feel that twist in my gut. What am I trying not to think about? That question alone moves you from passive recipient to active agent.
Then there's the social move. The Emperor's New Clothes move.
Find your people and say the quiet part out loud. This is the single most effective way to break collective dissonance because it converts a private experience into a shared one. The moment one person says, I'm seeing this too, right? And someone else says, oh, thank God, I thought I was the only one, the spell breaks. The performance collapses, and suddenly you're not crazy. You were just the first one to speak.
Which takes a certain kind of nerve.
It does. And it's easier in some contexts than others. But even a small act of naming, a conversation with one trusted person, can reset your whole calibration. You get confirmation that your perception is working fine. The problem isn't your eyes. The problem is the performance everyone else is maintaining.
Then there's the third move, which I think is underrated. The absurdist move.
Damnly.
Sometimes the gap can't be resolved. The contradiction is real, it's not going away, and neither side of it's going to budge. The exhausting thing is trying to resolve it anyway, constantly working to make it make sense when it fundamentally doesn't. The absurdist response is to stop trying. Embrace the contradiction. Live inside it. Laugh at it.
That's Camus' move in The Myth of Sisyphus. Sisyphus is condemned to push a boulder up a hill forever, meaningless, repetitive, absurd. And Camus says, we must imagine Sisyphus happy, not because the task has meaning, but because he accepts the absurdity and chooses to find joy anyway. The act of embracing the contradiction is itself the freedom.
That's not resignation. It's a different kind of agency. You're not resolving the dissonance. You're refusing to let it own you.
Right. The goal isn't always to make the contradiction go away. Sometimes the goal is to be able to hold it without being paralyzed by it. To say, yes, these two things are true and they don't fit together, and I'm going to keep functioning anyway.
Which is a skill, and probably the skill of the next decade, given where things are heading.
Say more.
Think about what's coming. AI-generated media that's indistinguishable from real footage. Synthetic voices. Deepfakes that pass every test. The gap between what we see and what we know is about to become a permanent feature of daily life. Every video, every audio clip, every photograph, you'll have to hold the possibility that it's real and the possibility that it's generated simultaneously. That's cognitive dissonance as a default state.
The old resolution strategies won't work. You can't just change the belief when the belief is about something you witnessed but can't verify. You can't add consonant cognitions because the whole point is that the evidence is ambiguous. You're stuck in the gap.
The skill becomes, can you hold contradictions without needing to resolve them? Can you function in a world where certainty is scarce and your own perception is constantly under question without either retreating into credulity or collapsing into paranoia?
That's the sweet spot. Credulity is believing everything. Paranoia is believing nothing. The sane response is something in between, a kind of provisional engagement with reality where you act on what you know while remaining open to the possibility that you're wrong.
Which is hard. It's cognitively expensive.
It is. But it's trainable. And I think the people who manage it best are the ones who've already made peace with the absurd. They're not expecting the world to be coherent. They're not surprised when it isn't. They've stopped treating contradiction as an emergency and started treating it as weather.
The crazy-making feeling Daniel describes, that sense of living in an alternate reality, of wondering if you're the only one seeing what you're seeing, that's not a personal failing. It's a predictable response to a specific set of conditions. Contradictory inputs, social pressure to conform, and no outlet for naming the gap.
The antidote is threefold. Name it. Recognize the mechanism. Share it. Break the isolation. And when it can't be resolved, embrace it. Stop fighting the contradiction and learn to live inside it.
The misconception most people carry, I think, is that cognitive dissonance is about changing your mind. That it describes the moment someone updates their beliefs in response to new evidence.
It's almost the opposite. The classic finding, the one Festinger documented in that living room in 1954, is that people often become more entrenched after disconfirmation. The belief doesn't weaken. It mutates to survive. The mind doesn't update. It fortifies.
That's worth sitting with. The mechanism we're describing isn't about growth or learning. It's about self-protection. It's the immune system of identity, attacking information that threatens coherence.
Like an immune system, it can overreact. It can attack things that aren't actually threats. It can make you sicker in the process of trying to protect you.
The question we should leave people with, and I mean leave them with, not answer, is the goal to resolve dissonance, or is the goal to learn to live inside it without losing your grip on reality?
Because I think the second one is where we're actually headed. The world isn't getting more coherent. The information environment isn't getting cleaner. The contradictions are going to slow down. So the people who thrive in the next decade won't be the ones who've eliminated dissonance. They'll be the ones who've learned to hold it without being paralyzed.
That's a skill set we don't really teach.
We don't. But maybe that's what a conversation like this is. Practice.
All right. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this possible.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If this episode made you feel slightly less alone in your own cognitive dissonance, share it with someone who needs to hear it, and rate us wherever you listen.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.